Good day. Welcome to the NJAFP podcast. And our theme is suicide prevention. This is the third and fourth one. It's about firearm suicidal prevention. And during this two podcasts, we are going to go over the counseling on access to lethal means and safe firearm storage, including the use of extreme risk protection orders and focus on high-risk group with access to firearms, which means the veterans and correction officers. I am Dr. Karen Lin. I'm the professor at Rutgers Rebel Johnson Medical School Family Medicine Department. And we are very honored to have a guest speaker, Dr. Michael Anestis, with us. He is a clinical licensed psychologist, executive director of New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers School of Public Health. And his work focuses on suicidal prevention among both civilians and service members, with a particular focus on the role of firearms. He is the author of approximately 150 peer-reviewed articles, as well as the book, Guns and Suicide, and American Epidemics, which was published in 2018. Dr. Anestis was the 2018 recipient of the Edwin Schneidman Award from the American Association of Suicidology in recognition of his early career achievement in suicide research, and currently served on advisory board for a number of organizations, including American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the JET Foundation. How are you, Dr. Anestis?
Doing great. Thanks for having me. I hope you're doing well too.
Okay. So we would like to continue our conversation on the firearm suicide prevention. I think back that when I was in medical school, or right now when I'm teaching the medical student, when we teach them to take history, that they would ask a patient, do you own a gun at home? And patient would answer either yes or no. And then we really did not equip them to continue the conversation. So most of the time they just jot down yes or no. So what would so this session we are going to focus on how healthcare professionals can help if we identify a risk. So what can we do to start from the medical education?
Certainly, and I will say in my training as a clinical psychologist, I wasn't really trained to do a whole heck of a lot with that. For most of my training, I was fortunate to be trained by a lot of folks focused on suicide prevention. So I think I got a little bit luckier than most, but I think it's pretty common across healthcare providers of all walks to be coming into this conversation feeling maybe a little bit ill-equipped about what am I actually supposed to do. It's sort of a shared experience for all of us. And I will say, look, there isn't one specific right answer. There are a lot of things we can do wrong, and there are a lot of things we can do right. And I think we're trying to, you know, lean more heavily on the do right side of things. And there are a few tools I think we'll talk about. There are interventions like lethal means counseling we can talk about. There are sort of free tools for folks to use on their own, like safe storage maps. And there's one for New Jersey we can talk about in a bit. And then there are also sort of online decision trees like Lock to Live that we'll talk about as well. And I guess I want to be aware that when I'm saying, what should you do to follow up, I am aware that different folks have different time constraints. So when you're interacting with a patient, you might not have time to go fully into lethal means counseling. And so the good news is I think there are a lot of tools that can adapt to the environment that you're in.
Okay, great. Then would you mind to explain several of the tools you just mentioned? And this way that, you know, we know that healthcare professionals supposed to have to be lifelong learners so that we can all learn.
Sure. So let's talk about lethal means counseling to start. The most common form you'll hear about is CALM, or counseling on access to lethal means. The more sort of emerging approach is what's called Project Safeguard. Both of these are essentially conversations you have with a patient that first determines do they have a firearm. But these are conversations meant to be collaborative in nature, where you work with the firearm owner to encourage them to adopt more secure storage practices, in theory to prevent suicide, but really to prevent any of a number of outcomes associated with ready to access to firearms, whether that's homicide, lethal domestic violence, unintentional shootings, theft, anything, right? And what these conversations involve is understanding what firearms does this person own? What are the primary reasons for owning them? How do they store them now, and why do they store them that way? Are they open to storing them differently under certain circumstances or not? What does and does not fit their values? So what you want to do is be very careful not to prescribe a specific set of actions that they have to take with their firearms. They're unlikely to accept that. Behavior change typically doesn't come from being told what you have to do. It comes from embracing intrinsic motivation that's already in place anyways. But it's a matter of, again, sitting alongside and speaking with the patient instead of standing over and talking to the patient about what they have to do. You will not get a firearm owner to say, now I'm going to store my firearm differently because that person said I had to. That's just not typically how this works. It's going to create the precise argument I think a lot of clinicians are afraid of having when they avoid this conversation in the first place. And what I'll say is that there is evidence behind these tools being useful. Project Safeguard is a clinical trial my team and I ran with firearm owning members of the Mississippi National Guard. And with a single 10 to 15 minute conversation using motivational interviewing, we saw increases in uses of gun safe and locking devices like cable locks that were maintained at 3 and 6 months. And 100% of the folks who received the intervention said they'd recommend it to a peer. So with a little bit of cultural humility and willingness to collaborate, you can see effective conversations, even with a really skeptical audience that might not really buy into your rationale.
Thank you. And the first one, the first tool is a lethal counseling method. And Dr. Anasis mentioned about 15 minutes of the Project Safeguard. Now, please give us a second tool.
Sure. A second tool would be the New Jersey Safe Firearm Storage Map. So this is there are maps that have popped up in several states recently. It started in Colorado, led by Emmy Betts and her team. She's an emergency physician out in Colorado. But now you see maps in Maryland, in Washington, in Mississippi, in New York, and in New Jersey. And what these maps do is they provide a list on a Google map. And in this case, the map is housed on the website of the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center. So gunviolencerechcenter.rutgers.edu. And it provides a list of locations on that Google map of New Jersey of in this case, FFLs or gun retailers who are willing to consider on a case-by-case basis storing an individual's firearms for them temporarily outside of their homes. This is a legal path. So we often tell people, hey, in a time of stress, it's maybe not the best time for you to have firearms around the house. But in a state like New Jersey, where temporary transfers of firearms are regulated pretty heavily, you need to provide them with a path for how to actually do that, right? So one of the things my team was hoping to do over the next year is increase participation in the map. We don't have enough sites on there, and they are too geographically focused on North Jersey. I want more in Central and South Jersey than we have now. But nonetheless, it's a tool that exists. It's something you can show someone that doesn't cost them anything, and then they can call on their own terms. And the beauty of it is, look, a lot of folks don't want to say, hey, I want to store my firearm outside the home because I'm suicidal. They don't want to share that. And they don't have to, right? You can store your firearm legally with these folks because you're going on vacation, because kids are coming to visit, or whatever reason they choose to give. I don't need the firearm owner to tell the gun retailer that they're suicidal. I just need them to have a legal path to get the firearm out of their home. And that's what this provides.
Thank you. And you also mentioned something about locktolife.org.
So locktolive.org. So lock, the number 2, live.org is a tool for physicians and their patients. It's an online free tool you can use on a smartphone or whatever that walks people through storage options for their family and their home based on both firearm access and medication access. And so what this does is, again, if you have a very short period of time with a patient, you can't get into lethal means counseling, or for one reason or another, you just choose not to, this is another sort of data-driven tool that can connect folks in need with an opportunity to find a safer environment with respect to their firearms and lower the odds of, again, not only suicide, but a host of other sort of dangerous outcomes that come along with ready access to firearms in the home. And it keeps the autonomy in the hands of the firearm owner. Again, one of the big concerns that firearm owners have in any of these interactions is that this is a gun grab. They're coming for my guns. You're gonna take my guns away. You're gonna threaten my rights. And that's something taken very seriously by the firearm owner. And so by providing a tool like this, you put it in their hands, you keep control in their hands, and you let them sort of do things again on their own terms in a way that feels consistent with their identity, with their culture, and with their rights. And I think that facilitates a much more productive conversation.
Correct. And we also heard there is New Jersey extreme risk protection order, though, that went into effect in September of 2019. Could you please explain that?
Certainly. So extremist protection orders, or ERPOs, they're sometimes called red flag laws. And I would encourage you to avoid using that term. No one likes being called a red flag. So just as easy to say ERPO or extremist protection order. These laws look different from state to state. There isn't one federal statute that says this is how they work, but there's a general underlying structure that's similar across all states that have ERPOs. And the basic gist is that some specific group of individuals determined by that state can petition a court to temporarily remove access to firearms from somebody who's determined to be at imminent risk to themselves or someone else. And so there's a few things to unpack there. In New Jersey, the folks who can petition the court are household members and law enforcement. If an ERPO is issued in New Jersey, that's sort of an indefinite removal of access. So that individual will not have access until they appeal the ERPO and win their appeal, at which point their firearms would be returned to them. And then it's sort of emphasizing that this is not a tool that says, well, you've been depressed or you are depressed and therefore you don't get to have firearms. That's not what this is about. This is about behavioral evidence of immediate risk to self or other. So not a diagnosis. This is not a stigmatizing of mental illness. This is simply saying due to these, you know, several behavioral indicators, there's clear reason to believe that in the coming hours or days, this individual will shoot themselves or shoot somebody else. And for that reason, they will not relinquish their weapons or store them more safely. And for that reason, we're petitioning court to remove their access. And so that's how this is structured. It's a last second, last ditch rule, because obviously that's not a collaboration. That is coming to get the guns, right? And so for a lot of firearm owners, that's going to feel awful. Just like involuntary hospitalization will feel awful to somebody, right? There's one of those last second risk is high and we can't agree on something. I need this person to be safe. That's what this tool is. And so the goal is to get ahead of the ERPO, right? To get someone safer without that. But this is that tool that's in the back pocket if it's truly needed.
Thank you. And as a clinical psychologist yourself, or even as a family physician, that sometimes we learn about patients' intention, and we have to go by this HIPAA rule, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. So how do you advise us to employ this law?
Sure. And you know, I'll preface my answer with, obviously, I'm not a lawyer, right? And so my interpretations of statutes should always be taken with a grain of salt. But what I'd say is in New Jersey, there's also a duty to warn rule, right? And so healthcare providers who have knowledge of an individual who's at imminent risk to themselves or someone else, and who they cannot engage in safety protocols that would mitigate that risk sufficiently, are really sort of duty bound actually to work with law enforcement. And so the way the ERPO becomes relevant to healthcare providers is that in that case of absolute severe imminent risk, where you cannot collaboratively work with that individual to reduce access to lethal means, you can bring law enforcement. Importantly, my understanding of the New Jersey ERPO is it has to be law enforcement in the municipality that that individual resides in, right? So if you're seeing that individual in a hospital in Newark, but they live somewhere else, you need to speak to law enforcement where that individual lives for this to work. But that's how the physician would come into this equation, is they would again, yes, there would be that breach of confidentiality, but within the context of that duty to warn, obviously, again, a last second tool. It's not what you want to be doing sort of on a whim for a variety of reasons, both in terms of protecting the privacy of your patients and also maintaining rapport and trust with your patients. ERPOs, some folks along the lines, once it's been issued and they realize it has been beneficial, they feel good about it, but in that moment, it's not gonna feel good. And so you gotta be sort of guarded in what you choose to do and why you choose to do it.
Yes, thank you. So in this section that Dr. Anastasis actually provides several tools for us, including lethal counseling method, the New Jersey Safe Storage Map, the lock2life.org, and ERPO. And I'm sure that the link and website will be in the New Jersey Academy of Family Physicians website that you can certainly check it out and to learn more for yourself and your patients. Dr. Anastasis, do you have any other advice for us that we haven't covered?
I would just say a couple of things. One is, you know, don't wait until the house is on fire before you buy a fire extinguisher. So when we're talking about assessing for firearm access and talking about being safer, don't wait until you think someone's at imminent risk for suicide before you ask about that and deal with it. The further upstream we go with that, the less likely you are to get into that situation. The most common story of American suicide is someone dies using a firearm on their first attempt before we knew they're at risk. And so the people left behind say, I never saw this coming. So the further upstream you can get to implementing safety with folks and getting them to change their norms around storage, the less likely you are to make that, you know, help that story play out again that way. And the second is make sure that when you're pursuing things like ERPOs, you're doing it with equity in mind. There's good data that ERPOs are successful in preventing suicide. In Connecticut, they said it was one out of every 20 ERPOs issued was thought to prevent a suicide. And in New Jersey, several hundred ERPOs have been issued since 2019. So you would think several suicides have been prevented, right? But the bad part of the data is that there's some data showing that Black and brown communities have had ERPOs issued against them far more often than white communities. It's white individuals owning firearms more often and dying by firearm suicide at a higher rate. And that means that the implementation of the law is disproportionately impacting one community over another. And no matter how well-intended your law is, if it's resulting in disproportionate impact on marginalized communities, that's a problem, right? So you have to be mindful of, am I pursuing this equitably every time I'm in this situation, or am I pursuing this based on some bias that I have? And be cognizant of that to make sure that we're not perpetuating problems in a system, even if that system is well-intended.
Thank you. And hopefully that we still have opportunity in the future to invite you back and to educate us more.